Hello. Yeah, this is working now. So, hi everyone. My name's Ian Hennessy. I am a consultant surgeon at Alderhay Children's Hospital, and I'm also the clinical director of innovation there, which is pretty much the best job in the world. I'm going to show a really gratuitous picture now of our children's hospital. Basically, it feels like I've been given the keys to the NHS's Ferrari. It is stunning. I mean, I don't think they're going to make an NHS hospital like this for a while, and it is filled with just the best technology. It's a GDE site. We get extra money to kind of soup it up. And underneath it, we have a 1,000 square meter innovation hub where we can co-create technologies. Now, the big vision behind Alderhay is to create this thing called a living hospital. And the old hospital had a bit of a character to it, but it was made up. It was, it's like, you know, you give a character to your car or something like that. But with a new place, would it be possible to actually give it abilities so that the building itself could be doing the treating? So we thought, how could we create a living hospital? And how, within that hospital, could you create, you know, a sensory system? We're really lucky in Liverpool, we have Sensor City. It's an area of sensor excellence. How could we create a brain to actually process all the data that's been generated by the hospital itself? And how could we give it a caring heart? This is such an important thing for any children's hospital, or any hospital in general, is that it's not just about the hard diagnostics and getting the best outcomes. You've got to care. I often think about this because half of what I'm doing at the moment is completely wrong. I will be doing things in theatre and prescribing treatments that don't work. Then in the future, people look back at me and say, what on earth are we doing? But what we are trying to do is we're trying to do it in a kind way, and we're trying to make the best decisions that we could at the time. So I think that caring, that kindness element of it is incredibly important. So then something really unusual happened, because we came up with this idea, and I was at a meeting in Liverpool, which was absolutely terrible and a complete waste of my time, I thought. And I bumped into a guy from this place called STFC Hartree Facility at Daresbury, which is, I hadn't realised, the largest high-precision computing centre in the UK. And they had just done a deal with IBM Watson for £300 million to take cognitive technologies. By cognitive, I mean technologies where computers interface in a more natural way with humans, you know, natural language, that type of thing, and looking for a use case for it. And I said, well, I can think of loads of use cases in the hospital. And we eventually said, we bid into this process, and we got awarded as one of the first use cases in the UK for deploying cognitive technologies. So we got an entire team of from IBM Watson and from the Hartree facility who came and spent a month in our hospital. And I got a month off work to do this, which was amazing. My colleagues covered for me the very last minute. And we sat down together and said, right, where could we have the biggest impact in the hospital in the shortest amount of time? What would you do, and where could these cognitive technologies work? And we mapped everything out. We did, you know, patient pathways, we looked at logistics, looked at everything else, and we kept on coming back to this heart and kindness element of things, of like, how do you make it a better experience for the children? And we all know that if children are well prepared before they come to hospital, then they're less anxious and less afraid. Really simple things like giving them a tour before they come in for their operation has been well shown to really reduce anxiety levels. So we thought, well, why don't we create a chatbot that can speak to children and to their parents and provide them with basic level information and eventually more advanced information to try and reduce that anxiety. And we mapped out all these points along the pathway, along this cognitive hospital pathway, where we could interact with them. And also, we looked at, you know, what could the doctors be getting out of it? Because as the patients start to interact with this cognitive platform, with this chatbot, we'll start to be able to see what questions they're asking. You can actually even start to analyse the tone in which the questions are being asked. What is the emotion behind what they're writing? I got given one of these tone analysers. Has anyone ever played with the tone and personality analysis on IBM's Watson? No? No one here tried it? It's great fun. What you can do is you can take your colleagues' emails, run them into it, and then send them the report back when they've sent you a rubbish email. And it's great fun. Oh, look at that, Colin. You're 97% angry in that email with a touch of disgust. It's absolutely. There's some people who just send really sad emails, and other people that are very joyous. It's just, anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. But you can do this for patients. You can look at how they're asking. Are they asking lots of sad questions? Are they really worried? Are they really anxious? And that's really useful information as a doctor. Now, I'm going to check and make sure. I've got tons of time. I'm going to just go off topic. Patients are really interesting in what they worry about and what really bothers them. What we started to find with the chatbot was that they were asking questions which they didn't ask me in real life. And that was really fascinating to me, because I see lots of children in clinic and they come on in and you know, I do the whole consultation. I'm a pretty fluffy doctor. You know, I'm a children's doctor. I'm a bit of a child stroke adult. I like to play with them. I like to think I'm very good with children. But they never asked me some of the questions that were coming in through the chatbot. One that I got through was, why are you putting me to sleep for this operation? Why don't you just wait until tonight? And it's just, you know, because children think of the anesthetic as sleep, but it's not sleep. So we started crafting our questions to really bring that up, to say it's not sleep. It's, you're going to be, you know, you can't feel anything. The next thing was that the children started asking a lot, which again, they never asked me in real life, is, will I wake up during the operation? Really common question that was starting to come through, with high levels of anxiety and fear associated with that. And again, that was really illuminating for me, because they had never asked me that beforehand. And people seem to think that the best interaction with a doctor is a face-to-face interaction in the clinic room, in the hospital. And I don't agree with that, because you can imagine, as a four-year-old child, you get brought to this strange, great big hospital with lots of sick children within it. You then get made to wait in a waiting room, and then you get brought, and you can hear other children crying. And even though we've tried to design the building so that it's as fun and as nice as possible, and then you come into my room, and it's my room, not their room. And I'm this great big bearded guy who, let's face it, I cut children up for a living. I'm pretty terrifying, okay? You know, with a big bald head and all the rest of it. And they just clam up. I had another girl who I'd reconstructed her abdomen years and years ago, and because she'd been born with her abdominal contents on the outside and we'd had to put them inside and make it all back up again. And she was always very sad and always had lots of abdominal pain, and we could never figure out what was getting to her. And I finally managed to winkle out of her in clinic that she was so sad because she wouldn't be able to have children when she was older. And I was like, you can have children. There's no reason why you can. And she was like, but I don't have a belly button. And it was like, and she'd never been brave enough to ask the question. And it was, imagine if I'd just been somehow fed that question beforehand, that she'd maybe put there in the middle of the night when she was worried, then I would be able to address that. And we never got abdominal pain from her again. It was just nervousness, it was just anxiety. Anyway, sorry, I've gone completely off topic a bit. But I'm a big believer that these type of interfaces are not necessary. This is not the death of medicine, as people seem to think it is. You know, that, oh, a chatbot will do it, and that'll be a dumbed down way of doing it. It'll be a great adjunct. I think it'll something that'll really make our interactions with our patients much fuller and much more effective as well, rather than constantly trying to winkle anxieties and worries out of them in a 5 to 12 minute interaction. So the project started. It's very interesting. I don't know if anyone had any experience in training a chatbot. It's a really interesting process. You'd think you as the expert would sit down and go, these are all the answers and these are all the questions and this is how these are going to link together. But it apparently just doesn't work like that. You have to get real questions from real people. And once the questions come in, you get the experts to categorize those questions and then answer them. So you create this kind of grounds truth, this core data set. But it has to be driven by contact with patients, and it has to, is molded by them. It's not all the way around, where we create a system which we impose on the patients. It is essentially a system which is created by the patients themselves. So we had to get teams of volunteers with iPads and other tablets to go around the hospital saying, do you have a question? Just ask me the question. And then we have got a team of clinicians who are then answering it, and then the really laborious task of categorizing what the question is like. This is not just a magic box which just does stuff. It's been a huge amount of work. especially getting the buy-in from the hospital to allow us to do this and have tens of volunteers running around asking people questions. So this was a really boring base system which we started with. But then the next thing we did was like, well, it's for children, so we're going to have to make it a really nice, inviting interface because they have got to engage with it. So the next thing we did was we created this app called Alder Plays. A bit cheesy, it was the best name we could come up with. This is our interface. And the idea behind it is that there's games within it, there's 360 tours of the hospital, they can pick their own character, which they can find in the hospital, little statues of the different characters around the hospital that they can hunt down. We've got augmented reality stickers, so that when you put a sticker on the child, they can scan it in, then it gets added to their collection. And within this app, we also have Ask Ollie. And Ask Ollie is this this button here. And this is for parents and children, so they can just ask these questions. One thing that was interesting was that we had to decide what the voice of the chatbot was going to be. And that is the level of information it gives and the tone of information and how it gives it. And I explained to the IBM and the Hartree team that we used to have, this is in Manchester Children's Hospital actually, we had this little kid called Dimitri, and he was from the Ukraine. And Dimitri, he had been brought across to us to operate on 16 years ago, it was 12 years ago, and then the hospital that sent him had closed, and no one could take him back. So he had to live with us for 12 years on the end of the ward. And Dimitri was basically the hospital mascot. So whenever a child would come into the ward, you would send Dimitri to go and have a chat to them. And then he would tell them all about the hospital and about having blood tests, and about going to theater and about x-ray. So he was an expert, but he wasn't a doctor. So it was that level of information that we wanted. Someone who is knowledgeable and can reassure and give you information, but it's not going to be over-medicalized, it's not going to be jargonized, it's not going to be kind of this paternalistic and this is how it is. It's like that helpful friend. So that was it's very difficult to write the answers consistently in the same voice. And this is about creating the character for the hospital itself. And this is an example of a conversation. And it's just a simple thing, because, you know, it's like, where are the toilets? You don't want a patient wasting 30 seconds of a nurse's time asking her where the toilets are. I mean, she'll tell you. I mean, she's very nice, but, you know, she could be doing better things. Same with me. I spend most of my time answering questions which I don't need to answer. This is just one of the characters, Chirp, that one's called. You can get the dance function for Chirp. And again, it's an incentivization model for the children. I think it really runs into that children, you can't just tell them to do stuff. As much as you'd like to say, you've got to incentivize it, somehow you've got to make it fun. And they really enjoy chatting with the chatbot. It's something fun. It makes the hospital a more alive place. The fact that you can actually have a discussion with our hospital, not with the people that are with it, with the actual hospital itself. I mean, it's still in its infancy. We're still getting there, but it's. And then we did some fun stuff. This is a, the AI is a chatbot. It's a conversation engine based on IBM's Watson conversation engine. You can take that and you can put it into things to bring them to life as well. So this thing here, this is a fascinating thing. This thing's got a Cognitoi. I would watch this company. This company have decided that they're going to create an engine for creating characters for toys so that your pedalimobile, your bike, your teddy bear can have a specific character that's been decided on by the company to interact with. So we can have that dinosaur speaking as if it's our hospital. You could theoretically put that beside the patient's bed and have a chat to them. You could send it home with them afterwards so you can nag them. You know, have you done your breathing exercises? You know, but in a nice way. But you know, there's a possibility of taking something home. This is another one. This robot here, I was testing this out at the Hartree facility. This is called the Pepper Robot. And the Pepper robot is a deeply unsettling experience, and I would not recommend it in any way for a hospital environment, because what it does is it looks at your face and locks onto your eyes and looks at you when it's speaking to it. And I think they were trying to make this friendly, but it's not. Right? So Pepper is not going to get deployed in any form of children's environment because it's super creepy. And also, the kids would rip its arms off as well, I think. It's just, where was I? Yeah, so that's, the what we're trying to create. We're trying to create the future of healthcare. And I think, you know, this creation of hospitals that have actual abilities is a key part of it. And we started off really simple. I like to say simple. This has been taking us about a year and a half to do already, with teams and teams of people and enormous amounts of resource from the Hartree and from IBM. And it's been a lot of work, even just to create a simple chapel. And also the governance of getting it deployed, because this is live now. You can download this, it's on our website, you can ask it a question, you can knock yourself out. And to get the hospital to take the risk of doing that was actually really, really difficult. And I had to use every ounce of IOU I've had from everybody to try and get this through, because people are just very, very nervous about it. Now, I've got 10 minutes, so I might just chat about some other things, which I think about an AI, which is maybe getting out of the context of our of our chatbot. But
why don't we pause at that point, Ian, and we carry on? But I just wonder if there are any questions coming up. So essentially, we thought we'd use this session to say AI is happening in our daily lives. You know, barcode scanners at supermarkets show one sector taking advantage of the image recognition bit of artificial intelligence, but our sector is also using it. And, you know, chatbots are in use in real life in hospitals across England. If you need a bit of help in understanding the language of artificial intelligence, augmented intelligence, image recognition, chatbots and whatever, half of the report is full of a glossary of the stuff that I don't really know the difference between. But we wanted to show that data is saving lives, is improving outcomes, is improving value, and here I think is improving experience and care.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of your monitoring of what the AI is actually talking to? Because you mentioned, say, kids asking questions like, am I going to wake up? You wanted to give the right answer to that.
So the Carol, basically her job, she's got a portal, Open Innovation Hub, which has got all the questions coming through. Different questions will flag up in different ways. So we've got a kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down button and a comment button. So if people don't like an answer, she will be able to pull out an answer which they don't like. At the same time, she can pull out the intent and the entity analysis of what people are asking about. We have a particular set of warning questions which come up, particularly around suicide, depression, profanity actually. You know, there's all sorts of areas around there, which will flag up. That said, this is not a 24-hour-a-day monitored system. And luckily so far, we've not had any of those questions, although that was one of the main anxieties around it, is that what if people are putting in child harm type questions into it, child abuse type questions into it, worries about, you know, people going to harm themselves and worrying clinical information. So that is a component of it, and we do have someone monitoring what's coming through, and there are alerts which will pick that up, but it's not a 24-hour monitored system yet. And that was actually one of the main reasons why a lot of people didn't want me to do this. They were like, this, you know, this looks like a, you know, this is a clinical risk. Yes and no.
Yeah. So sorry, that's really interesting. I'd just like to ask, so that sounds like it's almost like a social network that's got a moderator in place. It's essentially the same idea, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the advantage is that when they put the information in, it is completely de-identified, and there's also a scrubber that if people try to put a name in or a personal bit of information, it will scrub it off.
Okay.
Because there's big privacy concerns around all of these areas. So it's quite key that we have these type of systems in place to give that assurance to the board and to everyone else that this is something which is not going to blow up in their faces. And this is the first time that it's really been done. Actually, this was the first deployment in a hospital anywhere in the world. And we got into Wired off the back of it, made worldwide press. But with that, being the first to do something has incredible nervousness around it. Now, what you got to remember is that a child could leave a note anywhere in the hospital with the same thing on it. They could scribble a thing on their bedpost. You know, there's lots of different ways that we could do this, but we don't ban crayons in the room just in case they write us a note. So it's how do you get people's head around this? And anyways, this is much safer than what currently exists, because at least there is a way to actually look through it and find all this information out.
Okay, we have some more questions.
Could you expand a bit on how you got acceptance within the hospital for what you were trying to do, please?
Yeah, you just don't go away. That's just... So, it's interesting. It does feel like people are just throwing logs onto the train tracks, be it from data governance, ethics, funding, finance, and just every time you come up, you just got to stop the train, get out of the train, move something out of the way. And you have to have very high level support for it as well. But the problem with your main support being high level is you can't use it all the time. And most of the barriers to this actually comes from middle level time management. So you have to build up a trust and a relationship that you're not going to do something totally crazy, and that you are keeping risk registers and you are paying attention to all these various aspects of governance and just doing it properly. Because the minute you lose trust, that's when you go back to square one again. So it's keeping that going. And you've got to be really persistent. And this is why I think healthcare technology lags behind every other, sector, is because there's these extra levels of things, hurdles you have to get through, and you just need the enthusiasts to be able to get through it.
Hiya. I just wondered if there was a voice recognition option. Yeah. And the second part is it multilingual?
Sorry?
Multilingual?
No. So it's not multilingual. There is a voice recognition component that struggles with Scouser, which is really embarrassing. So at the moment, it's a text input, but on your tablet, you can actually use the voice to text function on your tablet. And the Siri voice text and Android actually works really well. So if you just press the microphone button, it goes in. But we do actually have a voice text function, but it uses a different voice text function, which has a real problem with the local accent. So at the moment, it is inputted through other means.
Any more?
You said earlier that there's a problem with people saying this is the death of medicine,
yeah.
And that rather it should be seen as an adjunct or an enhancer of medicine.
Yeah.
So have you seen attitudes change? Did you encounter that attitude amongst staff and or patients and their families? And have you seen that change, that people appreciate it as enhancing and maybe freeing staff up to do other more human things?
I would say not yet, because it's only really just been launched, and it's starting to bed in. I think what's interesting in the hospital is that people now tolerate me, if you see what I mean, in that they won't completely dismiss it out of hand, and they're like, well, maybe that's not for me, but I'm not going to stop it. And I've got one colleague in particular who whenever I get a new idea that comes in, I go and tell him the idea. And if he hates it, I do it. He's a great barometer for what's a good idea if he hates it, from a technology point of view. But he doesn't block me. And that's, I found that's been the change over time, is that now that the culture of innovation at all the Hayes, the people that don't particularly like this type of thing, of which, that's probably about 50 to 60% of the population, at least they're not obstructive to it. On just the premise point of view, they can be procedurally, but that's just the nature of hospitals. We've definitely seen a change in the hospital, and I think moving to the new building was very useful as well, because it's a completely new environment, so it's going to come with new types of technology. But there's certain people who've only just got smartphones, so You know, that's a level.
I wanted to finish on the point that you made, and we are running out of time, so I'll just wrap up. But I wanted to go back to that point about, is this the death of medicine or not? And the thing that I was really intrigued about, sort of beyond the so apparent patient experience, family experience benefits that this approach can take, is the way in which you've managed to glean more information out of the consultation using alternatives to or supplementing face-to-face one-to-one consultations. Because, of course, when we look at the demography, we look at the financial and workforce challenges of the sector, it's not going to be possible to provide every one-to-one face-to-face consultation that would be needed for a growing and aging population in future. So we're going to have to practice clinically with alternatives to supplement one-to-one face-to-face consultations. So to give a glimpse of what's happening now and what's possible for the future is what we try to put across in these 30 minutes. If you want to hear a little bit more about other people's work and the collective views of the pioneers like Ian, what barriers they're facing, what obstacles they'd like to be overcome, come along to the 12:50 session to hear sort of high-level findings from this report. Thank you very much.
Cheers.